الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم. میں آج تمام دوستوں کو اس نشست میں خوش آمدید کہتا ہوں. آج ہم ڈاکٹر خالد زعیب صاحب کے ساتھ موجود ہیں اور یہ نشست عمومی سوال و جواب کے لیے مختص ہے. ہم سوالات اس نشست کے شرکاء سے براہ راست بھی لیں گے اور آپ انٹرنیٹ پر بھی ہم سے ہمارے فیس بک اور ٹویٹر اکاؤنٹس پر سوالات کر سکتے ہیں. پہلا سوال میں کروں گا, اس کے بعد پھر باقی جو دو سوال کرنے کا ہیں وہ ریز ہینڈ کا بٹن ہمیں سوال دے سکتے ہیں. ڈاکٹر صاحب, یہ پہلا سوال ہے. تالیہ راولپنڈی سے پوچھتی ہیں کہ دین کو لفظ لائق کیا مراد ہے؟
قرآن مجید میں جو لہو و لعب کا لفظ استعمال ہوا ہے کئی جگہوں پر, ومل حیات الدنیا الا لہو و لعب, اس میں ایک لفظ ہے کہ جو لہو ہے اور ایک ہے لعب. یہ دنیا کی زندگی کے بارے میں اللہ تعالیٰ نے دونوں کو استعمال کر کے بتایا ہے کہ یہ اگر انسان سنجیدگی کے ساتھ نہیں گزارتا, اس کے اصل مقصد کو وہ اہمیت نہیں دیتا کہ جو اس کا حق ہے, جس کے بغیر انسان بے مقصد رہتا ہے, تو اس کی زندگی لہو و لعب کے علاوہ کوئی اور مقصد نہیں رکھتی. لہو در حقیقت ان ایکٹیویٹیز کو کہیں گے کہ جو انسان کو بس غافل کر دیتی ہیں, جو بے مقصد ہوتی ہیں, جس میں انسان کے لیے زندگی کے حقائق کے ساتھ کوئی تعلق نہیں ہوتا. جو لائب ہے اس کے اندر, اس میں مزید کھیل کود کا بھی پہلو ہے, یعنی وہ چیز کہ جو انسان پھر اس طرح سے اپنے آپ کو مطمئن کرنے کے لیے, خوش کرنے کے لیے اختیار کرتا ہے, کہ جس میں وہ جو کچھ کر رہا ہے وہ اس کا نصب العین بن جاتا ہے. وہی چیز ہے کہ جس پر کہ وہ فوکس کرتا ہے اصل مقصد بنا کر, اور زندگی کس مقصد کے لیے ہے, بنانے والے نے انسان کو کیوں بنایا ہے, اس سے وہ کیا کیا تقاضے کرتا ہے, ان چیزوں سے اس طرح کی ایکٹیویٹیز کا کوئی تعلق نہیں ہوتا. آپ یوں سمجھیے کہ انسان بعض اوقات کھیل کود بھی کرتا ہے, خوشی بھی مناتا ہے, خوش گپیاں بھی کرتا ہے. ایک وہ شخص ہے کہ جو اس طرح کی ایکٹیویٹیز کو اپنی زندگی کے اصل مقصد کے ساتھ اس طرح سے مربوط کر دیتا ہے کہ یہ ایکٹیویٹیز اس کے لیے وقتی طور پر اس کے اوپر جو سنجیدہ ایکٹیویٹی سی ایک بوجھ سا پیدا ہو جاتا ہے, انسان کچھ اکتا سا جاتا ہے, تو اس کو دور کرنے کے لیے, رفع کرنے کے لیے اختیار کرتا ہے. لیکن اگر انسان کے لیے یہی ایکٹیویٹی اصل نصب العین اور مقصد اور زندگی کے اوپر غالب اور حاوی ہو جائے, تو یہ وہ چیز ہے کہ جس کو قرآن مجید کنڈیم کرتا ہے اور یہ کہتا ہے کہ اگر انسان اصل مقصد کو فراموش کر دے تو پھر زندگی کی حقیقت اس کے علاوہ کچھ نہیں رہتی.
جی شکریہ ڈاکٹر صاحب. ڈاکٹر صاحب, ماہم سوال کریں گے.
ہیلو ہاں جی, السلام علیکم. مائی کوشچن از, کین موریلٹی بی کوڈیفائیڈ ان ورڈ؟ فار ایگزامپل لائک اسٹیلنگ, وین دیٹ از دی اونلی آپشن فار یو ٹو فیڈ یور ہنگری چائلڈ, وٹ وڈ وی کال دیٹ؟ از دیٹ امورل اور جسٹ سروائیونگ فار لائف؟ تھینک یو.
What I have understood from your question is, and please correct me if I have not understood it properly, morality at times can mean that you want to feed your hungry child. Can it be possible that morality would entail for a desperate mother nothing but the attempt that she is making to feed her child? Is that what you wanted to ask?
Let me let me rephrase her question. She asks, can morality be codified in words? For example, stealing, when that is the only option for you to feed your hungry child.
Okay.
What
okay, I'm sorry.
Call that?
I just missed it.
Moral or surviving for life?
You see, when we mention morality, it would normally be stated positively in the form of principles which are universally acceptable. Everybody knows what is right from what is wrong. Everybody knows that there are certain things which we know from inside our nature that they are desirable, and there are others that are condemnable. Under normal circumstances, there are no confusions. However, there are occasions when the circumstances are not quite normal. Your example is one case in point. A mother has no other means to be able to support her child but to go for stealing something from a shop or from a rich man's house. In that case, of course, she has to take a decision between two options. She has to go for the lesser evil. Leaving her child to die of hunger is an evil. Stealing is an evil as well. She will, of course, make a choice between the two. And I'm sure in most cases, mothers would opt for a choice whereby they will steal something if that is the only option available. Of course, she'll try to go for as many lawful, legally, morally acceptable options. But if I accept your assumption that there are no options left to her whatsoever, then most certainly the option of stealing is what she will go for. And we hope that the Almighty is not going to blame her for doing it. Within this very desperate situation, there are still certain grades, there are certain levels. I mean, the mother can actually steal only to the extent that is desperately needed by her child. But some other mothers might actually avail the opportunity once it's allowed for her to steal, she would say, why not to go for a much bigger attempt to gather as much of food stuff that is available as possible. So in that case, again, of course, the question of morality would still stay, even when you are desperate. And therefore, there is some justification for you to do something which is otherwise, under normal circumstances, immoral. If you do something, it should be as less as is possible. I would not blame the mother who decides that I am not going to steal at all, and would hope and pray to God if some other source might enable her, justifiable, morally correct source, might enable her to feed her child. I'm sure that option is also going to be attempted by some mothers, and that again is going to be, of course, a desirable way of facing this very difficult and desperate situation. So when the situation is difficult and desperate, there is a difficult choice that has to be made by the individual. In some cases, some acts of morality may get justifiable, but even then, you're not permitted to go beyond limits. In other cases, some people actually may still opt for going for only the acceptable ways of satisfying your desperate needs.
You, Dr. Saab, this is a question from Omar in Hamburg, and he asks, does agnosticism lead to kufr and why? And he says, I personally think that there is no harm in saying that I may believe in God, but I can't necessarily know it.
You see, agnosticism can be a position held by an individual who is making an attempt to understand what the truth is. Don't forget that as believers, we normally believe in the traditional manner. We are born in families which are traditionally believing. But then, of course, there comes a time in our life when we are mentally maturing and we have access to other points of view, and our point of view, our faith is challenged. There can come a stage in our life when we might find that we're not actually quite comfortable and convinced about our point of view. When you say that you adopt a philosophical position, telling yourself that it is just not possible, that again could be a temporary phase. To accept it as a permanent solution to the problem of the reality of life, of course, is going to be wrong. I would never use the expression kufr for most of these thinking processes, because kufr is something which has to do with the attitude of the individual. Individuals find themselves at various different stages of their understanding, and while they're using their intellect, they come across new realities, they get confused, they are challenged, they make progress, they experience, and as a consequence, they are normally, if they are thinking mind, they normally change and improve. And therefore, I think if an agnostic, well, if somebody who thinks that he's skeptical about the understanding of religion, if he has a thinking mind and he has not decided to just stay where he is, then this position can change. But the position of agnosticism, let me say this way, is not acceptable to Islam. It as a permanent understanding of dealing with reality is certainly something which should not be considered as acceptable and desirable.
Thank you, Dr. Saab. Coming a little from Hikmah side of religion to the Sharia, Sadia from Rawalpindi asks, and her question is in Urdu. Islam mein preferable to ek shadi hai, magar char shadiyon ki ijazat kin halat mein hai? Quran ke hawale se jawab hai.
Dekhiye, ye jo mamla ek se zyada shadiyon ka hai, ye aise Quran Majeed mein bayan nahi hua ke Allah Taala ne ye farmaya ke ek to ek normal desirable cheez hai, वैसे तुम ज़्यादा भी कर सकते हो. असल में लोग पहले भी एक से ज़्यादा मर्द शादियां कर रहे थे. अल्लाह ताला ने जब इंसान के इस दुनिया में आने की स्टोरी को बयान किया तो हमें यह बताया कि सबसे पहले इंसान जो इस दुनिया में आए वो एक मर्द और एक औरत थे, और वो शौहर और बीवी भी थे. और ज़ाहिर है कि इससे मालूम हुआ कि जो बिल्कुल नेचुरल फितरी तरीका है रहने का, उसमें यही अरेंजमेंट होगी. हाउएवर, ज़िंदगी में बहुत से मसाइल होते हैं, बहुत सी तब्दीलियां आती हैं, जो पॉपुलेशन की कॉम्पोजिशन है जेंडर वाइज, उसमें तब्दीली होती है, बाज़ औक़ात मसाइल होते हैं. तो उन मसाइल को सामने रखते हुए बाज़ औक़ात इसकी ज़रूरत पेश आती है कि एक मर्द एक से ज़्यादा निकाह कर सके. ये इस्लाम से पहले भी हो रहा था. क़ुरान मजीद ने एक ख़ास मौके पर, जब ग़ज़वा उहद में बहुत से मुसलमान शहीद हुए और यतीम बच्चे और बेवाएं इसके नतीजे में वजूद में आईं, तो उस मौके पर अल्लाह ताला ने ख़ास तौर पर यतीम बच्चों की किफालत के मामले में ये भी तजवीज़ किया कि एक सलूशन ये भी है कि तुम उन बच्चों की माओं को अपने घर में निकाह के ज़रिए से ब्याह के ले आओ और इस तरह से तुम्हारे लिए उनकी किफालत की जिम्मेदारी आसान हो जाएगी। इससे हम ये इन्फर कर सकते हैं कि कुरान मजीद ने अगर इस बात का तज़करा किया तो एक बड़े इम्पॉर्टेंट अजीम एक सोशल नीड के तहत किया और लोगों को अर्ज किया, उनको इनक्रेज किया कि वो ये काम करें। ज़ाहिर है कि जब आप ये कहते हैं ना कि ये नीड के तहत ऐसा होता है या होना चाहिए, तो या तो आप नीड डिफ़ाइन करेंगे या फिर आप ये कहेंगे कि ये उसूल है और हर फर्द, हर मर्द इसको अपने तौर पर उसूल को सामने रखे और तय करे कि क्या उसकी ये कभी ज़रूरत बनती है या नहीं बनती है। अगर मिसाल के तौर पर कोई मुसलमानों की हुकूमत ये तय कर दे कि हम उस नीड को डिफ़ाइन करेंगे तो कर सकती है, इसलिए कि वो चीज़ें के जो जायज़ हैं, बाज़ औक़ात अगर कोई हालात की मसलहत है उसके मुताबिक उसको पाबंदी उस पर लगा दी जाए, तो ये कोई ऐसी चीज़ नहीं है कि जिसको कि आप नाजायज़ कहेंगे। लेकिन आम हालात में ज़ाहिर है कि मर्द से यही तकाजा किया जाएगा कि वो इस बात को तय करे, और ये आप ना भी कहें तो एक बड़ी नेचुरल सी बात है कि हर नॉर्मल इंसान मर्द वो ये देखेगा कि मैं अपने मौजूदा फैमिली के हालात में एक नई तब्दीली लाने के लिए सोच रहा हूँ कि जिसके नतीजे में लाजमन रद्द अमल और नेगेटिव रद्द अमल होगा, तो मैं इसको सिर्फ उसी सूरत में करूं कि जब मेरे लिए उस फैसले के करने के लिए मॉरल जस्टिफिकेशन मौजूद हो और मैं वाकई अपने आप को इस मामले में इंक्लाइंड और मजबूर महसूस करता हूं कि इसके बगैर एक इम्पॉर्टेंट नीड पूरी नहीं हो सकेगी।
जी शुक्रिया डॉक्टर साहब। ये एक सवाल है हमारी बहन फरहीन मतीन का, ये दानिश टीवी के तवस्सुत से आया है। वो पूछती हैं, द क्वेश्चन इज इन इंग्लिश, शी आस्क्स, आई वांट टू नो इफ द सिंबल्स ऑन डॉलर नोट एक्चुअली रिप्रेजेंट एंटी क्राइस्ट।
आई हैव ओनली barely been able to understand the question, but let me say honestly, I have no research and understanding on it. There are many people who make a claim that that is what it is. As an outsider, an ordinary observer, I sometimes wonder why a government, a state as important as United States of America would allow something to appear on the currency note which happens to be a symbol of some religious movement and as a consequence may actually annoy many others and create unnecessary doubts about what this nation is doing and what direction it's moving towards. But it's just a question that comes to my mind. It could be possible that there is a negative, sinister purpose behind that kind of a symbol. But honestly, take my word. You know, indulging in such speculation is probably not very useful for us. We are an ummah who have been entrusted an important task, and that is to disseminate the final message of God that has been fully preserved. We have been made the custodians of it. We have to understand the message. We have to practice it. And as best as is possible for us, we ought to make arrangements to let each and every human on the face of this earth know about it. Now, that task is so huge, enormous, that our energies should better be directed towards such positive activities and projects which would invite us to inform people positively. When you start speculating about things and start thinking negatively, you're not open for others positively. So I would say that this research is something that should go on, but don't allow it to bother you too much, or else you might lose the real sense of direction that we Muslims ought to have in order for us to remain positive, for the message to be properly delivered to the rest of the world.
Hey, Dr. Saab, next question is from Gary. He asks, I would like to know where the premise of people condemned to hell will not reside there forever. Is hell a temporary punishment for purification purposes? For example, the Christians who do not confess to polytheism?
You see, the Quran has many mentions, passages, where we find words which say, Khalidina fiha, about people who are going to reside in the hell, that they are going to reside there forever. There are some Muslims who do say that when it comes to the mention of the paradise, there is an additional word of emphasis added, Khalidina fiha abada, which essentially means the same thing. However, it is noticeable that at least in two different passages of the Quran, while describing the hell and the punishment that is to be endured, the words are talking about the possibility of some criminals to be residing there forever. But when it comes to the question of residing in the paradise, The wording chosen by the Almighty says that they are going to reside therein forever, forever. So it is as if it has been repeated, it has been emphasized even more. However, what I would say is that the expression that they are going to live therein forever can actually have two meanings. One meaning could be that the people who are going to be declared criminals, unforgivable criminals, they are going to be required to be consigned to the hell fire to reside therein forever, meaning to reside there for as long as the Almighty has decided for hell to remain. And the other meaning could be that they are going to reside there forever, literally. Unending punishment is going to be inflicted upon them for as long as it is going to say, and it's going to say, stay forever. My inclination is that the first understanding is probably what it is. And there is a mention in the Quran which leads me to believe that probably that understanding is the more likely of the two possibilities. It's mentioned in Surah Hud, which is the 11th surah of the Quran. I cannot mention the exact verse, probably it's verse 107 or somewhere around, which says that the Almighty is going to cause people to be consigned to hell. They are going to reside there forever. Madamatis samavatu walas. So long as the heavens and the earth remain, stay. Illa masha arabuk. Except for what your Lord may desire. In other words, this particular verse is clarifying that the punishment and the reward of the hereafter is what the Almighty has decided for a certain duration of His own grand scheme, the length of time of which we don't know, but it is not necessarily a lasting scheme which is never going to end. There are other mentions in the Quran which lead us to believe that as far as the paradise is concerned, the eternity could actually mean literal eternity. But this particular passage in Surah Hud, the 11th chapter, gives us reasons to believe that it probably is more likely that as far as the punishment of hell is concerned, even though of course there's no reason for anybody to take it lightly, even if it lasts for a very long time and is not forever, yet the fact seems to be that they'll reside there forever means for as long as God's scheme of punishment is going to last.
Sure, sir. This question is from M. And the question is about a verse of the Quran. Quran says, but know, by your Lord, they will not truly be deep until they make you, O Muhammad, judge concerning that over which they dispute among themselves, and then find within themselves no discomfort from what you have judged, and submit in full willing submission. And the question is, kya ye ayat is waqt bhi daagu hoti hai? Agar hoti hai to kis tarah? Ya ye mauquf ho chuki hai?
Now, what confuses me is, what language should I answer the question?
You can answer either.
Right. I think because I can see that there are some people who can understand English only, and everybody who understands Urdu, alhamdulillah, understands English as well. So let me do it in English. You know, the mentions in the Quran wherein the Almighty is requiring the believer to follow the messenger, may God's mercy be on him, actually means that the believer has to understand the Quran and follow it as best as he understands it, sincerely, positively. The believer has to follow the sunnah, the religious practices which have come down to us in a way that they are completely reliable and authentic. There is no doubt in the process of them getting transmitted to us, like in the case of the Quran. Don't forget that the Quran and the Sunnah were both brought by no one else but the messenger, may God's mercy be on him. So when we follow them, we follow the messenger on the one hand, and we follow God Almighty on the other, because the messenger is the representative of God in this world. However, I'm sure that you're not going to spare me by just this much of the answer. Of course, the question would arise that if we are getting information which is neither in the Quran nor in the authentically transmitted Sunnah, which has been transmitted through practical process of transmittance from one generation to the other, But we are actually talking about some statements of the Prophet, may Allah's mercy be on him, which have come to us through individuals, which are normally described and categorized as hadith. If there is a verdict given by the Prophet which has to do with religious matters, and we have understood that verdict in the light of the Quran and Sunnah, that it is explaining some part of the Quran and Sunnah, most certainly that part would also become binding on the person who has understood it that way. But don't forget the fact that some of these explanations that have come to us through hadith may not actually be binding us to do something, but may actually be giving us a preferred way. For example, we know that the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, prayed prayers, some of which were obligatory, some of which were non-obligatory. So if we get an information from hadith and we are perfectly convinced that the information is correct, and the information is informing us that it's a great idea that apart from the five obligatory prayers, you pray in addition some other non-obligatory prayers. Now, that mention, even if we do not practice it, it's not going to mean that we are violating the meaning of the verse of Surah Nisa that you have quoted. So yes, this verse, some part of it is applicable to us now as well, but with certain qualifications. Finally, don't forget that this particular verse is actually talking about a situation that could only be there when the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, was physically present, because it's talking about disputes. There used to be people who would bring their disputes to the Prophet, who would perform the function of a judge. The Quran here is saying, when you bring in your disputes, whether pertaining to your social life, your political life, your economic matters or whatever, even if the disputes have nothing to do with what we normally categorize as religious matters, whether it's a dispute between husband and wife or whatever, if the Prophet, may Allah's mercy be on him, gave a verdict, that verdict has to be taken as final. Not just that, the verdict has to be accepted without any reservations. This, of course, is a possibility that could have only occurred during the lifetime of the Prophet, may Allah's mercy be on him. However, in other cases of religious matters, if there is a hadith that seems to be satisfying the conditions of acceptability, most certainly it is binding on us if there is a mention in it which actually binds us to do something.
Maham's turn to ask a question.
Okay, assalamu alaikum again. My question is, when a person is no more, we see his or her family making prayers, having prayer meetings for them. However, in my understanding, that counts as the relative or the family person fulfilling their own obligation by praying for the deceased. So just you tell me your viewpoint, like, do those prayers have an effect on the deceased, so to say, hisab kitab? Can you like just shed some light on it? Thank you.
You see, there are two possibilities. One possibility is that somebody has passed away, and of course we would make arrangements for the funeral prayers, which is a sunnah. Unfortunately, in most cases, ladies don't know what happens in the graveyard, but of course men go and they they bury the dead in the grave. After the grave has been prepared and the final preparation is over, is completed, we pray for the deceased again. Thereafter, there are no directives nor any rituals which have been mentioned in the Sharia. That doesn't really mean that we cannot do anything. We can pray individually, we can pray collectively. However, no collective prayer should be made to appear as if it's a part of the Muslim ritual, because that is what really can cause some people to start believing that such practices are also a part and parcel of the religion or the religious practices that were given to us by the Prophet, may Allah's mercy be on him. So it is desirable that we do our whatever prayers we want to make for the deceased individually, and even if we come together, you know, we can talk about the good performance contribution of the deceased, and we can also talk about her history and you know, in good words, and in the process, if we also pray, there's no harm in it. What you didn't ask, and I was a little surprised that you didn't ask that, what is actually prevalent, at least in the subcontinent, is a practice which is known as Isal-e-Sawab, the transfer of reward in the account of the deceased, whereby the Quranic verses and surahs are recited, some other acts of piety are performed, God is remembered through various different attributes of him, and all these practices are done with a view to transfer the reward that the reciter, the doer, has gained for himself in the name of the deceased. This idea is against what the Quran has clearly mentioned, wherein it is said, لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. Man is not going to get the credit of anything except for what he does himself. So prayer is no problem. Prayer, you asked, would it benefit? I don't know. God would decide. If a person deserves that prayer made for him to benefit him, should benefit him. And this decision is going to be taken by the Almighty on the basis of the performance of the individual. And he would decide as to whether a person deserved that a prayer done for him should be effective for him. Then of course it would be effective if that's what the decision is. But it is not necessary. However, we have been encouraged to pray for the deceased relatives and friends. It's natural. As emotional humans, loving and caring, as we care and sympathize with our friends and relatives in this life, we likewise sympathize with them and care for them even when they go to the next phase of life.
Kaisar
Sahab
will ask his question.
Doctor, my question is, Ustad has written in Mizan that Sunnah has been transmitted through the consensus of Sahaba and their perpetual practice. But after the period of Sahaba, Ustad is just standing for the consensus only. My question is, today, for example, we have to look for some practice, whether it is a Sunnah or not. If the perpetual practice has been stopped at Sahaba, what is the source in which I can see whether sunnah, something is a sunnah or not. Is it that I have to turn to the written scriptures again to see the consensus of the ummah written in those scriptures or something else?
You see, the process of transmitting sunnah was initiated by the Sahaba. But I beg to disagree with you that it stopped there and then. No, it continued. And what we have today with us is a result of exactly the same process. The companions transmitted the sunnah practices to the next generation called Tabi'in, and they in turn transmitted those practices to the next generation, and so on. It just continued likewise. For example, prayer. The prayer was prayed in the first generation. The second generation started growing up and they observed the prayer taking place, so they naturally adopted it as a part of their religious life. And then the next generation observed their elders and they adopted it, and so on. Now, of course, you're asking, how would we distinguish between a religious practice which is sunnah and a practice which is a non-sunnah? I've deliberately used the expression non-sunnah because a non-sunnah can also be divided into two categories. A bid'ah, religious innovation, and a practice which does find some justification in religion because it was practiced, or there is a reason for us to believe that it was practiced by the Prophet, may Allah's mercy be on him. If not on a regular basis, he practiced it on some occasions. How would we distinguish? Let's take the example of what I've talked about in the answer that I gave earlier. A man dies, his loving family arranges for a process of recitation of the Quran on the second or the third day of his death. This, of course, recitation of the Quran is a religious practice. We have to decide as to whether it is a sunnah given to us by the messenger as a part of the religious package, or it is an innovation. What we'll do is that we'll find out whether this practice is going on elsewhere in the other parts of the Muslim world. Is it happening in other parts of, let's say, Pakistan? Is it happening in India? Well, we would say, yes, it's happening all around. Probably some are disagreeing, other are doing it. We move still beyond these countries and you start finding that these practices don't take place when somebody dies. So we will have a good reason to feel that most certainly this religious practice is not the sunnah that was given by the Prophet, the Messenger of God, may Allah's mercy be on him, for the Ummah to follow. Had he been given to us by him, there wouldn't have been a possibility for that practice to not have been followed in the entire Muslim world. Five times a day prayers is taking place everywhere. Muslims perform Jummah, Eid prayers, fasting, funeral prayer, bathing the dead, burying the dead, and so on. So many practices practice all throughout the Muslim world. Now, if this practice is actually found in only one geographical locality of the Muslim world, Muslim Ummah, then clearly it couldn't have been a part of the religious package given by the messenger. But there's still two possibilities. One possibility is that it's a condemned religious innovation. The other possibility is that it's a non-sunnah practice which may have some justification. Well, for that we will resort to hadith as well. Because in case of hadith, you do at times find that the Prophet, may Allah's mercy be on him, performed certain religious acts which he did not arrange to become a part of the sunnah to be followed by everybody. I'll give you an example. If you say your Fajr prayer in Pakistan, you would say two rakats, two units behind an imam, and we know how it is. Surah Fatiha followed by a passage of the Quran which is longer than what normally recite in the other prayers, likewise in the second rakat and so on, and that's about it. If you say the same Fajr prayer in Malaysia, for example, you would find that the imam, to your surprise, after getting up from the ruku of the second rakat, is actually raising his hands and praying what is called Dua-e Qunut, which some of us have been reading and reciting in their Witr prayer. The Malaysians, following the Shafi'i practice, they do it. But this is not followed everybody everywhere else, in most other communities of Muslims. But I would not call it a bidah, a condemned religious practice. Why? Because this practice finds a justification in the text of hadith, wherein we know that the Prophet, may Allah's mercy be on him, on some occasion, on a particular occasion, continued to pray Dua-e Qunut in Fajr prayer, probably for a month's time. So we'll disagree with what these Malaysian brothers are doing, but only to the extent that we would say that it's not something that was desired to be a permanent part of the Fajr prayer. But that's about it. We would not say that it's something which is completely unacceptable, because after all, it's a difference of understanding. However, the fact that it is not practiced everywhere in the Muslim world is a clear indication that it was not given by the Prophet to the Muslim Ummah as a part of the Sunnah practice.
Thank you, Dr. Saab. This question is from Muhammad Yasir. We received it through our Facebook account. And he asks, ye baat kahan tak durust hai ke rizq muqaddar mein tay hai?
Dekhiye, اللہ تعالیٰ نے قرآن مجید میں رزق کے بارے میں جو بات بیان فرمائی ہے اس سے بات پوری سمجھ میں آ جاتی ہے. وہ یہ ہے کہ اللہ تعالیٰ جب بھی یہ فرماتے ہیں کہ تم کماؤ، پیسہ کماؤ، تجارت کرو، زراعت اختیار کرو یا جو بھی، اس کے لیے الفاظ ہے وَابْتَغُوا مِن فَضْلِ اللَّهِ، اللہ کے رزق کو تلاش کرو. اس کا مطلب کیا ہے؟ اس کا مطلب یہ ہے کہ اصل میں آپ کو جو رزق ملے گا، اس کے لیے دو شرائط ہیں. ایک یہ کہ اللہ تعالیٰ نے رزق کو آپ کے لیے رکھا ہوا ہے، آپ کی دکان میں، آپ کے کھیت میں، آپ کی فیکٹری میں، آپ کے آفس میں، وہ موجود ہے. لیکن اس کا وہاں موجود ہونا کافی نہیں ہے، آپ کو اس کو تلاش کرنا ہے. آپ جائیں گے، دکان کھولیں گے، تو وہاں جو رزق آپ کا پڑا ہوا ہے وہ آپ کو ملے گا. البتہ اس کا یہ ضرور مطلب ہے کہ اگر فرض کیجئے کہ اللہ تعالیٰ نے آپ کا رزق کہیں نہیں رکھا ہوا اور آپ اس کو تلاش کرنے جاتے ہیں وہاں جہاں وہ نہیں ہے، تو آپ کو نہیں ملے گا. سو یہ دو چیزیں بیک وقت موجود ہونی چاہیے، اللہ کا فضل، آپ اس کو اس کی تقدیر کہہ دیں جو اس نے طے کیا ہے آپ کے لیے ایک امکانی پوٹینشیل رسک کی صورت میں، اور آپ کا اس کو حاصل کرنے کے لیے تگودو کرنا, یہ دونوں چیزیں ساتھ ملیں گی تو آپ کو رزق ملے گا.
What is the nature of miracles and how it is different from a magic trick?
Miracle is an extraordinary thing, event that takes place which you normally do not experience in the normal day-to-day life. You know, we know many miracles which Musa alayhi salam, Moses was given. Jesus Christ alayhi salam was also given many miracles. You don't normally find people causing people who are dead to come back to life. In the case of Musa alayhi salam, Moses, he had his staff, his stick, which he used to do many miraculous things. It caused the river to be, its water to be broken into two big components, and the land, the dry land that thus appeared, allowed his companions to walk through. God is the one who is running the affairs of this world. He is the one who has caused the normal, natural life to proceed in accordance with the laws of nature, in accordance with the cause-effect relationship which we have become more aware of as a result of the progress of science. However, that doesn't really mean that God is bound to continue to run the affairs of this world only within the limits and constraints of those laws. Honest to God, we don't even know when we talk about miracles that they take place only as a consequence of the laws of nature getting violated. We know very little about what those laws of nature are. God Almighty can cause sometimes to allow a certain extraordinary event to take place, which a normal human being is not able to explain immediately. But you never know if the principles and laws behind this extraordinary event were unfolded, we might have also been able to know how it all happened. So you see, human knowledge is a big gift, reward of the Almighty. Yet it has its limitations. We know only to the extent that we have discovered as yet. And what God allows and causes things to happen is something, of course, which we don't know as yet. But maybe tomorrow we might be able to know more about it. After all, 100 years ago, if man was informed about the fact that somebody sitting in one part of the world would be comfortably communicating with some other people residing thousands of miles away from him, it won't have been believed in by anyone. But now it really is commonplace. This is because those principles have been discovered, and they have been harnessed and put to use in a way that now it really is no more a miracle. So the miracles that we think are miracles are actually extraordinary things that have happened because God has caused them to happen, but they may or may not be actually happening as a consequence of the laws of nature getting violated. God, if He wants, He can actually go beyond those laws to cause them to happen, and He may actually do things within the domain of the laws of nature. It's a different matter that we have not as yet been able to understand how those laws are getting followed on the one hand, and yet what is happening is extraordinary. Magic is something different. Magic is, to begin with, is performed by a magician. If you go by the statements, the conduct, the character of that person, he is neither claiming to have brought any message from God. He's just at best is stating that I've practiced something over a period of time and I'm doing it to earn the attention of people so that they get impressed, so that they might spend something on him. And of course, it really doesn't serve any useful purpose except to impress people. In case of the prophets of miracles, the prophets and messengers had a character which was absolutely clean. People living during their times would know that these people have impeccable personalities, and if they are claiming to present something in the name of God, there is very little reason to doubt it. And the message itself makes a lot of sense. It appeals to the intellect. It satisfies human nature and human conscience. And at times, in order to attract the attention of some people who are otherwise not quite as easily drawn towards the message, God arranges for certain extraordinary things to happen, which when they happen through the messengers, fitting into the scheme of a certain presentation of the message, well, they are very conspicuous and prominent in getting the understanding from the addressees that they are really miracles and not just magic which is done for the sake of fun or earning some money.
Paz will ask the next question. Paz sahab will ask the next question.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. We see in the Holy Quran that God says that God does not put burden on a soul more than its capacity. But what we see in the physical world is a kind of burden that is probably more than the capacity of individuals. The kind of suffering that we see in the world. Would you like to help me in identifying the right meaning of this word? Is it only related to the matters of akhirah?
La yukallifu Allahu nafsan illa wus'aha. La nukallifu nafsan illa wus'aha. These are the verses that your question is referring to. God does not make people accountable, responsible, beyond their capacity. We shall not make a soul responsible beyond his potential. To my understanding, it means two things. At times, some of these verses would refer to one of them. At times it would refer to the other, and on some occasions the expression may actually be referring to both possibilities. One possibility is that the Almighty is saying that the Sharia law that He has given to his servants is a law which is very much possible for them to be practiced. He has taken into consideration the potential, the capacity of the individual. He hasn't desired from his servants in his Sharia, in his law, anything which is beyond their capacity. That is one meaning. The other meaning that the Quran is mentioning is that when a certain individual is going to be held accountable on the Day of Judgment, he or she is going to be asked to answer only to the extent that was possible for him or her to do. Nothing beyond an individual's capacity is what he or she is going to be held accountable for. That understanding is most clearly mentioned in verse 42 of Surah 7, wherein the Almighty says, those who believe and do good deeds, we shall not hold anyone responsible for more than his capacity. Such are the people who shall be the inhabitants of the paradise. They'll reside therein forever. The third meaning, possible meaning, which some people have in mind and therefore they get confused, is that God is not going to inflict a pain on any human which he or she cannot bear. My understanding is that this meaning is not possible to be construed from these verses, for the simple reason that anyone who dies because he's gone through some pain, something has happened to him, to his health, which has caused him to not be able to survive anymore. In other words, the disease, the illness, the pain, or whatever, has actually gone beyond what the person could actually bear, and therefore he has died. So I think this meaning is not what the Quranic verses are referring to. It's only the first two meanings that I have already mentioned.
Maaz Saab is asking questions which we received in our Facebook inbox. So
okay.
He's allowed to ask more questions, but these are on behalf of other people. Maaz Saab, please go ahead.
Maaz Saab would do well to change his voice a little bit.
Okay. Sir, I have a question that he's writing that I have been married for 10 years now, but I feel the love and respect between us is decreasing day by day, and I have been thinking of suicide more often as our fights and arguments are increasing. What can I do to get those thoughts out of my mind?
One of the things that I can tell you is that there's no need for you to commit suicide, because this is quite a common experience. So, you should have better reasons to commit suicide. Well, my friend, the thing is that life is an ongoing process. It's dynamic. It's a challenge. There is no reason for you to get so dejected and depressed because of certain relationship not coming out to your expectations. I think I would suggest that give your circumstances a serious thought. Why is it that you and your wife are not having a good relationship with each other? Could it be that you are at fault, or is it that your wife is at fault? I can assure you that in most of the cases, the possibility is that both are at fault. You need to talk to each other, and find out where are we going wrong? What's the problem? At times it's a very good idea to consult somebody else, maybe a friend of yours, a relative of yours, Maybe your wife can talk to some ladies. Maybe together you both can talk to an individual or a couple. There are some counselors now available, I'm sure, everywhere. The kind of progress that the discipline of psychology has now made, it really is amazing how it can help us in overcoming some of the problems of relationship that we have in families and in friends. So there's no reason why you should think of such an extreme step. And after having said all that, if nothing works out, after all, God Almighty, as a final resort, has also mentioned the possibility of divorce. I didn't want to say that, but I wanted to make a complete answer. After all, if a relationship is impossible to develop and to improve, which is what you should only conclude after you have exhausted all other possibilities. You've talked to each other, you've prayed for it, you've involved others to help you out, got to the specialists, and then you come to the conclusion that is neither your wife is at fault nor it's your fault. It's such a huge difference in your personalities that probably there's no way that you can actually have a good family life. Then, you know, as good humans, part ways in a pleasant way. But there is no possibility at all that a Muslim, believing Muslim, can ever contemplate the possibility of committing suicide. It's a huge crime, which should not even, the thought of it should not even occur in one's mind.
Ali Imad Sahib will ask the next question. Ali Imad Sahib from Sakhar.
Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Sir, my question is sunnat ke regard mein hai ki aapne jo jawab diya tha usse ye malum hota hai ki sunnat par har jagah amal ho raha hoga. मैंने गांधी साहब की सुन्नत की जो उन्होंने 27 कलेक्ट की हैं और दूसरी जगह पे वो कहते हैं कि हर चीज सुन्नत है उसके हिसाब से वो जो सेइंग है कि जिसने मेरी किसी सुन्नत को जिंदा किया उसको सो एंड सो सवाब होगा कोई हदीस है तो इसका थोड़ा कंफ्यूजन था प्लीज
देखें मैं जब भी इस हदीस को सुनता हूं तो मुझे ये ख्याल आता है कि इसमें जो रिवॉर्ड बयान हुआ है वो बहुत ह्यूज है. खैर, अल्लाह ताला रिवॉर्ड देने पे आए, सवाब देने पे आए. अल्लाह ताला रहीम करीम रहमान है, फयाज है. लेकिन आम तौर पर उसूल ये होता है कि जो बदला है वो असल में अमल के मुताबिक होता है. हमारे यहाँ आम तौर पर इससे ये मतलब ले लिया जाता है कि मिसाल के तौर पर नबी अकरम सल्लल्लाहु अलैहि वसल्लम का एक आम तरीका ये था कि आप बैठ के पानी पीते थे और लोग अब खड़े होकर पीते हैं, तो मैं बैठ के पीऊँगा तो मैं वो अजर कमा लूँगा. अगर इसका ये मतलब है तो ज़ाहिर है यही बयान करना चाहिए. लेकिन मुझे ऐसा महसूस होता है कि हम ये जो बात बयान कर रहे हैं दीन के बारे में, जाहिर है कि हम एक नॉर्मल सिचुएशन सर्कमस्टेंसेस की बात बयान कर रहे हैं ना. कुरान मजीद महफूज है, सुन्नत भी महफूज है. कहीं एबनॉर्मल सर्कमस्टेंसेस में, अल्लाह ना करे कि वो कोई बहुत कॉमन हो, किसी बस्ती में कि जो नई बस्ती बनी है, आप जाएं और आप ये महसूस करें कि वहां जो दीन पर अमल हो रहा है हर जगह, वहां उस पर भी नहीं हो रहा, और बाज दीन के हिस्से मतरूक हो गए हैं. जैसे हमारे तबलीगी भाई हमको बताते हैं कि हम बाज़ औक़ात बाज़ मुसलमानों की बस्तियों में जाते हैं और वहां नमाज ही नहीं हो रही होती. मस्जिद मौजूद होती है, नमाज नहीं पढ़ी जा रही होती. और यू नो इस तरह के मामलात बाज آئسولیٹڈ کیسز میں دور دراز علاقوں میں یا اللہ معاف کرے کوئی بڑے بگڑے ہوئے کسی حالات میں ایسا ہو سکتا ہے. یعنی ایک عمومی چیز کا ہونا اور اس کا اصول کے طور پر بیان کرنا اس بات کو ثابت نہیں کرتا کہ اس عموم کے کچھ استثنات ایکسیپشنز نہیں ہوں گے. تو وہ جو ایکسیپشن جب وجود میں آئے گا تو ایک بندہ مومن کا جو دین کے بارے میں غیرت کا رویہ ہے وہ اس کو مائل کرے گا کہ یہ دین تو ادھورا ہو گیا ہے, نامکمل ہو گیا ہے, مجھے اس کو زندہ کرنا ہے.
السلام علیکم. میری آواز آ رہی ہے؟
جی آ رہی ہے.
جی السلام علیکم. مجھے یہ سوال یہ کرنا تھا کہ جیسے کہ آپ بھی فرماتے ہیں اور اکثر گاندھی صاحب بھی کہ جب تک انسان جانتے بوجھتے کسی کو انکار کرے گا تو اصل میں مطلب گناہگار وہ ہے اور اللہ تعالیٰ ان کو مطلب وہ جو ہے کہ ساری زندگی مطلب جہنم میں جائیں گے اور اللہ تعالیٰ ان سے نپٹے گا, اور دوسرے لوگ جن پہ بعض دفعہ ہدایت نہیں پہنچی اور ان کو وہ بات نہیں سمجھ آئی تو امید ہے کہ اللہ تعالیٰ ان سے نرمی برتائے گا اور وہ بخش دیے جائیں گے. تو میں یہ پوچھنا چاہ رہا تھا کہ جب ہم کبھی ہمیں موقع ملتا ہے دعوت دینے کا یا کوئی ڈسکشن کرنے کا نان مسلم سے, ہم ان کو یہ بات بھی میں کہہ سکتے ہیں حکمت کے ذریعے کہ تاکہ وہ اور طریقے کہ اصل چیز آپ کی اخلاقیات ہے اور اصل چیز ہمارا کام ہی میسج دینا ہے, ہم آپ کو میسج دے رہے ہیں, ہمیں یہ سمجھ آیا ہے, اور اگر مطلب اس میں کوئی زبردستی نہیں ہے کہ اگر آپ نہ آپ کو نہیں سمجھ میں آئے یا آپ کی نام کو نہ قبول کر سکیں تو پھر بھی اللہ تعالیٰ آپ کو جو ہے وہ جہنم میں ڈالے گا یا مطلب آپ کو نہیں بخشے گا.
دیکھیں جی, میرے خیال میں تو ایسا ہی کرنا چاہیے کہ آپ اللہ کے پیغام کو دوسرے کے سامنے اس انداز میں پیش کریں کہ دوسرے کو بات سمجھ میں آئے. یعنی ہم اپنی طرف سے بات کو بدل نہ دیں, یہ تو ہمارا اختیار ہی نہیں ہے, لیکن جو بات صحیح ہم کو سمجھ میں آتی ہے وہ ہمیں دوسروں کے سامنے ایسے پیش کرنی ہے کہ خدا تعالیٰ کے اس ارشاد پر عمل کرتے نظر آئیں. ادعو الی سبیل ربک بالحکمہ, تم اپنے رب کے راستے کی طرف لوگوں کو بلاؤ حکمت کے ساتھ. تو آپ ان کو یہ بتائیں گے کہ ہمارے اور آپ کے درمیان اکثر چیزیں مشترک ہیں, ہمارا دین انسانی اخلاقیات کے جتنے تقاضے ہیں ان کو پورا کرنے کو باقاعدہ دینی ذمہ داری قرار دیتا ہے. وہ ہمیں یہ بتاتا ہے کہ خدا تعالیٰ نے ہمیں یہ اخلاقیات دی ہیں, ہم اسی کی بنیاد پر آخرت میں جواب دیں ہیں. ہاں البتہ اس پہ مزید اس نے ہمیں ایک شریعت قانون دیا ہے جو کہ انہی اخلاقیات کے معاملات میں بعض جہاں سوالات اور الجھنیں پیدا ہو جاتی ہیں ان میں سے بعض معاملات میں وہ اپنا فیصلہ سناتی ہے. تو یہ سب کا سب ایک فطری معاملہ ہے کہ جس کی ہم آپ کو دعوت دے رہے ہیں. یہ حقیقت ہم تک پہنچی ہے کہ ہمارے پاس یہ پیغام اللہ نے کچھ انسانوں کے ذریعے بھیجا ہے کہ جن کو اسی نے منتخب کیا اور وہ اللہ کے پیغمبر ہیں, اور ہم آپ کے سامنے ان کی دعوت پیش کر رہے ہیں. یہ بات کہ جو شخص اس کو نہیں مان رہا وہ اس بات کو جان کر کہ یہ بات صحیح ہے انکار کر رہا ہے یا اسے بات ہی نہیں سمجھ میں آئی, یہ فیصلہ اللہ تعالیٰ کرے گا. یہ فیصلہ مجھے اور آپ کو نہیں کرنا ہے, اور نہ مجھے اور آپ کو کسی کو اس کے انکار یا ماننے سے گریز کرنے کے رویے کو کفر قرار دے کر اسے جہنمی قرار دینا, یہ ہمارا کام نہیں ہے. یہ کام تو صرف اللہ تعالیٰ کر سکتے ہیں کہ وہ یہ بتائیں کہ اے پیغمبر, آپ جن لوگوں کو دعوت دے رہے ہیں ان کے دل مردہ ہو چکے ہیں, وہ اپنے غلط رویے اور انکار پر اڑ جانے کے نتیجے میں ان کے اندر کا ضمیر مردہ ہو گیا ہے, وہ اب صحیح بات کو سمجھنے کی صلاحیت سے محروم ہو گئے ہیں. یہ بات ہم کیسے کر سکتے ہیں؟ تو ہمیں تو اپنا کام کرنا ہے اور اپنی بات کو پہنچانا ہے نرمی کے ساتھ, محبت کے ساتھ, دلائل کے ساتھ. سوال کریں گے لوگ, ہم جواب دیں گے اور ان کو پورا موقع دیں گے کہ وہ اپنی بات کریں, اس لیے کہ یہ پیغام اصل میں دل و دماغ میں داخل ہونا چاہیے, اور اس کے لیے ظاہر ہے کہ ہمیں اس پیغام کو پیش کرنا ہے جیسا کہ وہ ہے لیکن نرمی اور حکمت کے ساتھ.
السلام علیکم. Masa will ask questions from our Facebook.
Brother, I have last two questions with me. One of them is, pure reason for belief in God my revelation?
I couldn't get it. Could you repeat it?
My question is that, is your reason sufficient for believing in God minus revelation?
Okay. You see, humans have diverse abilities. There are some people who are more intellectually gifted, and there are others who, even though have intellect with them, they are more inclined to believe through other means, other factors and reasons, like experience. At times it's emotional inclination and so on. However, reason most certainly is a very important factor. And what we mean by reason is that we use our intellect, our mind, properly without allowing any unnatural outside influence to affect our thinking. So we proceed in a straight manner without allowing any obstructions to block our way. When we think that way, our mind takes us to a certain conclusion, which is also consistent with our nature, our feelings. So intellect on the one hand, and human nature, human conscience, both converge to get satisfied through the presentation that has been made. And when I say experience, what it means is that once your intellect, your reasoning leads you to a certain stage, to a certain level, you're inclined to start practicing what you are getting convinced that is making sense. Now your practice allows you the opportunity to experience. Your experiences start unfolding for you certain realities which under normal circumstances a person who is not interested may not actually go through. So it begins with reasoning, you have inner feelings as well, you go through experiences, and as the Almighty says, it begins to happen. He says, Allahu waliyyu allazeena amanu yukhrijuhum minaz zulumati ilan noor. God becomes the protecting friend of those who want to believe. He brings them out of the ignorance of darkness and takes them towards the light of truth and knowledge. But it happens gradually. It is primarily your seriousness of purpose, your sincerity, your decision that you've got to continue to think positively in the right direction, that enables you to have faith and belief. And as I said, reasoning is a very important part of it.
Gary asks, what is your opinion of Christians who come to the masjid to pray with Muslims?
If a Christian would ask me, and I will be the imam, I would welcome the idea. But I don't guarantee that every other Muslim is going to give the same response. And I won't blame those Muslims as well, because what you've asked is a difficult question. Some other Muslims might say that we would first ask you to observe us and first decide formally that you are a part of the Muslim community, and it's only then that you should be allowed to join. My own inclination is that that kind of an approach would unnecessarily stop the progress of an individual of coming close to Islam when he is showing an inclination that he wants to experience it before making a formal pronouncement. So I am clear, if I am given the charge of running the affairs of masjid or and somebody comes to me and asks me that can I join you, well, honestly, I remember it sometime, probably it was 25, 30 years ago. We had a friend from South America who was traveling all around the globe. And we were living in a hostel, and he asked us if he could join us in prayer. And, you know, he was talking about Fajr prayer, which is not even possible for most Muslims to join because of the early time that it takes place. So he showed his interest, and I said, why not? I mean, you're most welcome.
There's a question from Shafiqur Rahman. Puchte hain ke assalamu alaikum, agar aap nazar bad par kuch roshni dal dein to nawazish hogi. Aur silsile mein kuch ahadees hame aksar sunne mein milti hain. Unke bare mein bhi scientific lihaz se कैसे पॉसिबल है कि सिर्फ किसी के देखने से कोई असर अंदाज हो जाए?
देखें जी, ये जो आप कहते हैं ना कि ये कैसे हो सकता है, ये असल में उसी तरह का सवाल है जैसे कि वो अभी मौजज़ों के मिरेकल्स के बारे में किसी ने सवाल किया था. इसका जवाब एक तो ये है कि वाकई मुझे नहीं पता कैसे हो सकता है, लेकिन ये होता है. मैं सिर्फ इसीलिए नहीं कह रहा कि ये अहादीस में बयान हुआ है, यकीनन ये एक बड़ा इम्पोर्टेंट रीज़न है कि मैं ये कह रहा हूँ, लेकिन हदीस के बारे में तो मज़ीद तहकीक करके ये भी बताया जा सकता था कि शायद इसकी असल जो बात है या उसका पस मंज़र है वो पूरी तरह से वाज़े नहीं हुआ. हकीकत ये है कि बहुत से वाक़ियात इंसानी तजर्बात में ऐसे होते हैं कि जो आप को मजबूर करते हैं कि आप ये सोचें कि प्रॉब्ली ऐसा होता है. अच्छा, ये कोई ऐसी चीज़ है भी नहीं कि जो आपका ईमान का हिस्सा है, ये तजर्बा है. उस तजर्बे के बारे में हदीस में बयान भी हुआ है, और जब किसी का तजर्बा और नबी सल्लल्लाहु अलैहि वसल्लम के बारे में ये दावा सामने आ जाए कि आपने इसको कन्फर्म किया है, तो ज़ाहिर है कि उस शख्स के लिए तो ये एक ऐसी चीज़ बन जाएगी कि जिसको कि वो इसका इनकार नहीं कर सकता. ये कैसे होता है? असल में हमारा जो जहन है ना, साइंसी जहन, जिसमें के कॉज इफेक्ट रिलेशनशिप जब तक एक्सप्लेन ना किया जाए, हम बात को मानने के लिए तैयार नहीं होते. इससे ये मुश्किलात पैदा हुई. वरना हकीकत ये है कि ज़िंदगी में बहुत से ऐसे हकायक वाकयात भी होते हैं कि जिनके बारे में आप ट्रेस करके पीछे से ये बता नहीं सकते कि ये कैसे हुए हैं, लेकिन द वेरी फैक्ट कि वो हो गए हैं वो इसका सबूत है कि ये हकीकत है. मैं आपको मिसाल के तौर पर कहता हूँ कि आप ये मुझे बताएं कि कल को क्या होना है, ना आपको पता है ना मुझे पता है, तो फिर ये कैसे होता है कि बाज़ औक़ात ख्वाब में ही लोग देख लेते हैं कि कल क्या होगा? अच्छा, ख्वाब तो आपका ख्वाब है, वो कल को हो जाता है, कैसे होता है? इसलिए इस बात को रुकावट नहीं बनाना चाहिए कि आपको चूंकि ये समझ में नहीं आया कि कैसे होता है इसलिए मैं नहीं मानूंगा. ना माने, सिर्फ ये है कि ज़ाहिर है कि अगर आप पर कोई इत्मीनान हो जाए कि एक बात नबी सल्लल्लाहु अलैहि वसल्लम ने फरमाई है, तो फिर तो ज़ाहिर है कि उसको आपको एहतरामन सुनना चाहिए और ये तय करना चाहिए कि मैं इस बात पे गौर करूँगा. ज़ाहिर है एक ऐसी बात है जो मुझे अभी तक समझ में नहीं आई. कुरान मजीद ये बयान करता है उसूल कि मुझे और आपको ये तो हक हासिल है कि हम जिसको कहते हैं ना तवक्कुफ़ करें कि अच्छा गौर करते हैं, बात अभी तक पूरी तरह समझ में नहीं आई, لیکن جو بات سمجھ میں نہیں آئی ہے اس کا انکار کیسے کر سکتے ہیں؟ قرآن مجید نے کہا نا کہ قیامت کے روز بعض مجرمین کو یہ کہا جائے گا کہ تم نے انکار کر دیا مالم تحت بھی علما، اس چیز کے بارے میں کہ جس کے بارے میں ابھی تمہیں بات ہی سمجھ میں نہیں آئی تھی، تمہارے علم نے اس کا احاطہ ہی نہیں کیا تھا. سو علم کے معاملے میں آدمی کو ہوشیار تو ہونا چاہیے لیکن ہمبل ہونا چاہیے، ایروگنٹ نہیں ہونا چاہیے کہ چونکہ مجھے بات سمجھ میں نہیں آئی ہے اس لیے بات غلط ہے.
صاحب ہمارے پاس پانچ منٹ رہتے ہیں، عرفان صاحب اپنا سوال کریں گے.
السلام علیکم.
وعلیکم السلام.
میں ایک تو چیز آپ سے شیئر کرنا چاہتا ہوں، سوال میرے خیال میں اگلی نشست میں اگر اس کا جواب دے دیں تو ذرا بہتر ہے. ایک تو یہ بات ہے کہ جو آپ نے فجر کی نماز کے بعد دعائے قنوت کا بتایا تو وہ آج کے پریکٹس میں ہے. میں یہ بتانا چاہتا ہوں کراچی میں چونکہ حالات زیادہ خراب ہیں تو اس سلسلے میں بھی ہماری اپنی مسجد میں جو کہ حنفی مسجد ادار ہے، پچھلے دو ہفتے سے ہم فجر کی نماز میں دوسری رکعت بعد رکوع کے بعد مسجد میں جانے سے پہلے قنوت ناظرہ کہتے ہیں اس کو، اور وہ ہم ریگولرلی پڑھ رہے ہیں. میرے بھائی سعودی عرب سے آئے ہوئے تھے، انہوں نے مجھے بات کی، انہوں نے یہ تھی ہمارے لیے تو پہلی تھوڑی سی تبدیلی تھی، انہوں نے بتایا کہ سعودی عرب میں تو بعض دفعہ اگر کوئی اس قسم کی آفت آ جائے تو پھر وہ ایون ظہر کی نماز میں پڑھتے ہیں، اور باقاعدگی سے نہیں، دو چار دن پڑھا اس کے بعد چھوڑ دیا. تو اس کی پریکٹس الحمدللہ یہاں بھی پاکستان میں بھی، یہاں کے شافعی لوگ تو کم ہیں لیکن اس کی ریکگنیشن یہاں بھی ہے، اور یہاں بھی لوگ اس کو جب بھی مصیبت وقت آتا ہے تو کراچی میں تو ہمیں مستقل کچھ عرصے تک پڑھنی پڑے گی، تو ہم نے یہ بھی رواج شروع کیا اپنی مسجد میں. اچھا دوسری جو سوال ہے میرا وہ یہ ہے کہ ڈاکٹر صاحب آج الیکشن کا زمانہ ہے، میں اگلے ہفتے اس کی تفسیر آپ سے پوچھوں گا. اور بہت یہ چرچا ہے آرٹیکل 62 اور 63 کا جس میں امین و صادق کی بات ہوتی ہے. آپ سے پوچھنا یہ کہ یہ بہت ہی مشکل کام ہے ایک ووٹر کے لیے کہ سلیکٹ کرے کہ کون امین ہے کون صادق ہے، تو کیا منیمم کوالیفیکیشن آپ سمجھتے ہونی چاہیے ایک آدمی میں جس کے لیے کہ ہم اس کو مستحق سمجھیں کہ اس کو ووٹ دے سکیں؟ آج چونکہ میں نے بھی نماز کے لیے نکلنا ہے، 8:30 بجے ہوتی ہے، تو میرا آپ سے گزارش یہ ہے کہ اس کا سوال کا جواب تھوڑا سا ہم سب اور بھی لوگ ہوں گے یہاں اگلے ہفتے کی نشست میں دے دیجیے گا. شکریہ
صاحب. ایک آخری سوال امان اللہ صاحب کا لے لیتے ہیں. ڈاکٹر صاحب ہمارے پاس 2-3 منٹ
بھی. جی
السلام علیکم ڈاکٹر صاحب. جی ڈاکٹر صاحب سن رہے ہیں آپ مجھے؟
جی بالکل سن رہا ہوں.
جی ڈاکٹر صاحب مجھے قرآن کے ترجمے اور ٹرانسلیشن کے بارے میں پوچھنا تھا کہ آپ کون سا ریکمینڈ کریں گے ہم کون سا پڑھیں؟
اردو میں؟
جی اردو میں بھی یا انگلش میں بھی کوئی ہے تو بتا دیں.
دیکھیں میں نے یہ دیکھا ہے کہ ترجمے کے معاملے میں مختلف لوگوں کا مختلف ذوق ہوتا ہے. میرا آپ سے گزارش یہ ہے کہ آپ خود بھی ترجمہ دیکھ کے مختلف ترجموں کو پڑھیں، اور جو ذرا 4-6 آیات پڑھ کے آپ کو زیادہ رواں لگے اس کو آپ اختیار کریں. ترجمے کی آپ صرف اگر بات کر رہے ہیں تو ایک ترجمہ جو اردو میں رواں ہے اور اچھا ہے وہ مولانا مودودی کا ہے، جو جس کی زبان بہت اچھی ہے، اور صرف اگر آپ ترجمہ پڑھیں تو آپ کو کافی بات سمجھ میں آ جاتی ہے. لیکن اب جو استاد محترم جناب جاوید احمد غامدی صاحب ترجمہ کر رہے ہیں البیان میں، وہ ترجمہ میں صرف اس لیے نہیں کہہ رہا کہ میرے استاد ہیں، وہ حقیقت یہ ہے کہ وہ ایک بہت عمدہ ترجمہ ہے جس میں زبان کی خوبصورتی اور اس کے ساتھ ساتھ جو قرآن مجید کی جو کلاسیکل اعلیٰ عربی ہے اور اس میں جو باتیں ہم عام طور پہ سادہ ترجمے میں اردو کے نہیں سمجھ پاتے، انہوں نے ان کو بھی کھول دیا ہے، بیان کر دیا ہے، ایسے ترجمہ کر دیا ہے کہ آپ محض ترجمے کو پڑھ کر یہ سمجھ جاتے ہیں کہ اللہ تعالیٰ نے پوری بات کیا کی ہے. وہ سلسلہ بھی جاری ہے، اس کے 2 والیومز آ گئے ہیں، ایک پہلا اور ایک چوتھا آخری، یعنی سورہ فاتحہ سے لے کے سورہ مائدہ تک پہلا تھا، اور سورہ قاف سے اور سورہ ناس تک یہ آخری ہے، اور درمیان کے دو والیومز ہیں کہ جو ابھی وہ لکھ رہے ہیں, تو وہ ایک بہت اچھا ترجمہ ہے. انگلش میں بہت سے ترجمے رائج ہیں. میں نے ابھی ریسنٹلی مولانا وحید الدین خان کا ترجمہ انگلش میں دیکھا. وہ ایک اچھا سادہ ترجمہ ہے کہ جو بات کو کمیونیکیٹ کر دیتا ہے. مولانا وحید الدین خان,
ہمارے آج کے پروگرام کا وقت ختم ہو گیا. میں المورث کی جانب سے تمام دوستوں کا شکریہ ادا کرتا ہوں. آپ اپنا اور اپنے پیش کا خیال رکھیں.